This past week, I spent 6 days and 5 nights with my 8th grade students as a chaperone on their annual class trip to Washington, D.C. Thank you for that. Thank you. The purpose of this trip was to bond as a class, to visit the important landmarks related to their civics lessons, and to get a deeper sense of the historical context that led to the most important events of our nation's timeline. We had a completely jam-packed itinerary that took us to nearly every museum, monument, and government building on the National Mall. Our tour guide was very knowledgeable, and though this was probably his 600th tour group, he still seemed quite enthused to quiz the kids on which president did this and which did that a century or so ago. But our tour guide's enthusiasm and experience was, sadly, no match for the 43 cell phones that my 43 students held in their sweatshirt pockets. But this was my first trip to D.C., and I was excited to finally go inside all those places that are depicted on my money and to get some clues about how the rights and wrongs of history might be shaping our nation's future. We went to the National Portrait Gallery that exhibits all of the presidential portraits. It was visually jarring to see how many proud male faces were looking out at me to the left and right of 1920 on our country's timeline. American women finally got the right to vote that year when the 19th Amendment was passed. This evoked a strong need in me to see a woman's proud face, proud and noble face, hanging on the wall just to the right of the 45th plaque. We visited the Capitol building to see where our elected representatives work, as well as the beautifully ornate Library of Congress attached to it. We were told that the 100,000 square feet of marble flooring, the hand-painted domes and arches, and the many, many bronze statues and busts were meant to impress the visiting foreign dignitaries of the time. I took this to mean that it was especially meant as a mark of equality in wealth and culture to our European dignitaries of the past. It bothered me that after having a war to distance ourselves from Europe and to differentiate ourselves as American, we spent so many resources trying to copy the European symbols of status. I much prefer the images of a scrappy, innovative, and fiercely independent nation. I was astounded when our guide insisted that our tour only went as far as these few rooms, and that we were not, in fact, allowed to see the halls nor offices where our own paid representatives work and make decisions that affect us. By the way, the painting on the Capitol building's rotunda is called The Apotheosis of Washington, and it was completed in 1865. I think there's a slide for it. Apotheosis means to elevate someone to divine status, and it depicts Washington in royal purple, flanked by the goddesses Victory and Liberty. Freedom, also known as Columbia, is just below Washington in a scene of war. He is surrounded by 13 dancing maidens representing the 13 colonies. Everyone is Caucasian. The resemblance to today's hip-hop music videos in which the male rapper shows off his wealth and status while surrounded by adoring women was not lost on me. I wonder if the Italian artist who painted it also saw irony in that liberty, victory, and statehood were represented as female figures that didn't even have rights or a voice at the time. While the art is incredibly beautiful, it seemed very un-American and irrelevant to my 21st century eyes. What impression did it leave on my young students who will be guiding us from the 21st century into the next? Our last day, we visited Mount Vernon, George Washington's expansive farm and estate. The guides were eager to show us the impressive furniture and decorations, the incredible view that overlooked the Potomac River, and to recount our first president's glory in battle. They never mentioned that 90% of the people residing on his land and contributing to his farm's wealth were slaves. I learned that only within the last 3 years were the numerous slave quarters opened to visitors' eyes, though they still were not included as part of the official tour. Some may say that I am unpatriotic for bringing up these disappointing elements from my trip to our capital, but I believe that it is my civic duty to speak up if I feel we continue to celebrate an outdated, cherry-picked image of our nation's past and present without focusing on making it more inclusive and representative of who we actually are as a people in the 21st century. Oh. After my whirlwind week of frescoes, statues, monuments, and oil paintings, my eyes and my spirit feel a sense of calm here in our simple chapel. This is a truly democratic place that represents our beliefs and nurtures us without the need for frivolity or pomp. Its clean lines frame what is actually important to us, and there is plenty of room for us all to be part of ensuring that what is addressed here under this roof reflects who we are, what we want to be, and how we want to grow as a spiritual society.
The service today is the second in a series called UU Theology for the 21st Century. And for this second in our series, I'm focusing on some of the challenges we face and helping us to lay out a new framework for consideration of what needs to happen for our theology to be relevant for the 21st century. What needs to happen for UUs to be existing in the future. I want to remind you that we have a companion class that goes with this sermon series, and it starts this Tuesday. We will meet the third Tuesday of each month at 2 and 6:30, and we'll go deeper on some of the topics that Roger and I will share in our monthly sermons and give you a chance for reflection and discussion. If you're planning on participating in the series of classes, I suggest that you get a notebook and bring it to class to help keep track of your thoughts and reflections as we go along. The book that we are using for this course is A House for Hope, The Promise of Progressive Religion for the 21st Century. It's by Rebecca Parker and John Burens, and some copies of it are still available in our bookstore. So this morning, I want to share a reading with you. It's the same reading that I shared at the service last month on our theme, but it frames so much of what we're doing in this yearly series that I wanted you to have a chance to hear it again. It comes from Rebecca Parker, former president of Star King Seminary. The UU curriculum, Building Your Own Theology, used in many of our congregations, reinforces the notion that speaking of ultimate things is something that each person has a right and obligation to do for themselves, and to do it from their own direct experience. This sensibility has great merit. It emphasizes the creativity, responsibility, and freedom that belong to each human being. It teaches that no creed, established system, or dominating culture should lord it over an individual's right of religious conscience. Often in interpreting Unitarian Universalism to newcomers, this is what we emphasize above all else. Unitarian Universalism is not defined by a set of beliefs or a creed or an established doctrine. Rather, we say, it is a way of being religious, a way that honors each individual's encounter with the ultimate questions and mysteries of life, and supports each individual in this religious journey, their search for meaning. This is all well and good, and I would not want to lose this emphasis. But a counterbalancing emphasis is also needed. It leaves an important reality in the shadows. And the important reality is this. When someone enters Unitarian Universalism, they do not arrive at no place. They arrive at some place. They enter a house, a theological house that already exists, that they did not build themselves. Unitarian Universalism has a theology. It is not my personal theology or your personal theology. It is the theology of a heritage, of a tradition, of a community. It is a theology that evolves over time, contains many diverse perspectives, and has some overarching characteristics. Being able to speak about the theological ethos or culture that is Unitarian Universalism can advance our multicultural, anti-oppression, anti-racism work. By becoming articulate, we can evaluate our own theological heritage in a more responsible way. We can say, this is who we are together. These are the gifts or the blessing of our religious culture that we have to offer in a multi-faith world. And these are some of the limits of our culture that require address. By becoming articulate about our religious culture, we come to know ourselves not only as theological, as recipients of a theological ethos, but also the shapers and transformers of it.
Our second reading today is by the Reverend Susan Frederick Gray, who is the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations, our association, of which we're a member congregation. This is from her column in the UU World Magazine of summer 2018, a year ago. Becoming the Religious People We Want to Be is the title. Susan writes, I am reflecting on the charge that the Reverend William G. Sinkford delivered to me during my installation at General Assembly in 2017. He said, call us to become the religious people we want to be. We have a new chance to move toward beloved community that can be squandered by failure of will or insistence on holding habits that point to our past rather than our future. Call us to a belief in the good news our tradition can offer and our communities can sustain. Susan continues, I may have been the one holding Sinkford's hand during that charge, but I believe his words were meant for all of us. Throughout my first year as UUA president, I have seen Unitarian Universalists taking up this charge, bravely embracing the responsibility of what it means to be a person of faith in dangerous times. I have witnessed people filled with unprecedented energy for what this faith offers. I have seen congregations with hearts on fire for the work of becoming a beloved community and doing justice within and beyond our walls. We love to celebrate when we were on the right side of history, when we let our faith and commitment to human dignity and commitment to universalism lead us into the practice of justice. But that is not the whole story. It is important to be honest about our complicated history. Not to bring shame or guilt, but to bring understanding that can inform our faith today. We are in a time of deep challenge and opportunity in our faith. The reality for many is dire. Increasing threats are real. Policies of the state seek to silence, imprison, deport, and even murder people. Our congregations are faced with important questions of how we answer to empire, as well as how to wrestle with how close we have become to beloved community, or how far we still have to go. It is important that we not let the opportunity or the urgency of this moment to slip away. Like the theme of General Assembly says, all are called to this work, and I believe we have been getting ready for it. My hope is that we continue our collective pace forward to become the religious people we want to be, the religious people we are called to be. Here ends the reading.
I'm very glad you're here today. In their book, House for Hope, The Promise of Progressive Religion for the 21st Century, Parker and Buren use the metaphor of a house to describe the theology of Unitarian Universalism. The house was built by all who came before us, heretics who challenged the status quo and offered the saving message of Unitarianism and Universalism. In the reading that I shared with you, Parker says, when someone enters Unitarian Universalism, they do not arrive at no place. They arrive at some place. They enter a house, a theological house that already exists, that they did not build themselves. When I entered a UU house for the first time, 30 years ago this year, I felt a strong sense of homecoming. Many of you have described a similar experience for your first visit. I didn't know much about UU theology at that first visit, but I did know that I felt welcomed and accepted with all my questions and all my uncertainties. That was the saving theology that I needed as someone who had felt shut out of my childhood religion. The essential message of Unitarian Universalism resonated with me on that day. I still marvel at the power of what Unitarian Universalism has to offer, but I am aware of some of our limitations as well. My motivation for this sermon and for the sermon series as a whole is for all of us to be active in the process of transforming our UU theology into relevance for the 21st century. Our task is to be stewards and shapers of this faith and keep it alive for those who follow, just as people kept it alive for when you arrived. Rebecca Parker says, we need to rethink our theological task, not just in terms of personal search for meaning, but in terms of the structure of meaning we inherit. And we must take responsibility for stewarding it and reforming it. Last month, in this sermon series, I highlighted the powerful and life-affirming aspects of our theology. Many of you told me that that sermon left you feeling affirmed, inspired, and proud. It is important for us to be grounded in the strength of our theology, and that is why I began the series with that sermon. But in order to move forward, we must also look critically at those aspects of our theology that no longer serve us, which may be holding us back from being powerfully relevant and life-giving in our current time. I'm going to lay out these issues today, and Roger and I will explore them further in monthly sermons and in our companion class. If you are new to us today, or if you're new to us in recent times and just getting a grasp of Unitarian Universalist theology, I want to say welcome to our house. And welcome to a process of reevaluating, a process of looking at what works and looking at what doesn't work, a sign of a healthy theology, a healthy community. Our world right now is in a period of transformation, and our saving and powerful message can make a real difference for people. Susan Frederick Gray said, "We have a new chance to move towards beloved community that can be squandered by our failure of will or our insistence on holding habits that point to our past rather than our future." So let me outline some of these theological ideas that point to our past that need restoration or perhaps replacement. But first, I want to remind you of the context in which Unitarianism and Universalism arose. Lindsay's reflection reminded us of our European heritage of the United States. And like our democracy, both our parent denominations, Unitarianism and Universalism, were born out of the Enlightenment era in the 18th and 19th centuries in Europe. One of the founding ideas of Unitarianism and an emphasis of Enlightenment thinking is the use of reason to discern religious truth. This separated the Unitarians from other Christians in the early 19th century. Our Unitarian forebearers stated that we should decide for ourselves what is true based on our own reasoning rather than an external authority, a radical idea at that time. Many of you left the church of your youth because you wanted to make your own choice rather than be told what to believe. This idea of the use of reason permeates much of our current UU theology. Another concept we inherited from the Enlightenment is the idea of the autonomy of the self. We are so used to this in our culture, individualism, the right of the individual. It all started with the idea by Descartes that some of you may have heard, "I think, therefore I am." This was a radical shift in thinking during the Enlightenment era, and our Constitution and Declaration of Independence are based on these ideas. Another Enlightenment era idea that is present in Unitarian Universalism is that human exploration and science will answer all our questions and cure all our ills. It is an inspiring and hopeful idea that came about at the same time as the new theory of evolution. Related to this idea is the concept of progress towards some universality, that there are certain ideas and truth and that in the days to come will be universally true for all. So I'm telling you about these Enlightenment concepts to make us aware that these are the concepts that inform white culture. We don't talk about white culture that much because it's sort of the water that we swim in. But Unitarian Universalism is steeped in these concepts. And if we are to develop a robust theology for the 21st century, it is important to understand how these ideas affect our current thinking and affect the culture in which we live. So let me walk you through a few of the ideas that I think we need to reconstruct and reframe in our theological house. Eschatology is the component of theology that looks at what we think about the end times, what is the destiny of humans, the destiny of the world. And Unitarians and Universalists have what I like to call the Star Trek eschatology. We believe that everything is going to keep getting better and better. Everybody's going to get along. Okay, there's going to be Klingons and Kardashians and a few other troublesome races. But basically, we're all heading to a perfect world where everybody agrees on everything. You're laughing. Another component of UU eschatology is the idea of the arc of the universe bending towards justice. This came from Theodore Parker, a Unitarian minister who was an active abolitionist during the Civil War. He said, "I cannot see the shape and length of the arc of the universe, but I do believe it bends towards justice." So how's the arc of the universe doing these days? The last 2 years have been disorienting and discouraging for religious liberals. For liberals, for a lot of people. Our sense is that the arc of the universe is doing what? Coiling back, flipping back. So how do we reshape our theology with a more grounded vision for what is the future of humankind, a more resilient vision? This focus on progress, always moving forward to a better and better world, has also led to an emphasis on perfection in our communities and an expectation that individuals need to be constantly improving ourselves. One of the founders of Unitarianism, William Ellery Channing, talked about how we all hold the image of God in us, and we need to work and strive to bring out that image of God. What a meaningful theology in the context of people being told that they're depraved. But the negative side of that is that we think that we need to strive to better ourselves all the time. It's great when it inspires us to do justice work. But focusing on the idea that we strive for perfectionism can be very debilitating. There's also this Enlightenment idea about progress will lead to this universal truth, this Star Trek vision of everybody agreeing on everything. But who gets to say what that is? Who's in that conversation? Whose ideas are the ones that form that? You say that we're open-minded. We pride ourselves on being open-minded, but in a lot of ways, we're very dogmatic. We just think that everybody hasn't caught up to us yet and figured out that we have the right answer. I want to touch a little bit on the theological idea of ecclesiology. How is it that we come together? What holds us together? And this reflects back on the idea of the individual as the component that drives the connection. Of course, we know in our own culture this focus on the individual has led to fragmentation and loss of community. This comes out in UU culture in an interesting way. The first principle versus the seventh principle. The inherent worth and dignity of every individual and the respect for the interdependent web of which we are a part. Well, what happens when my inherent worth and dignity steps on your interdependent web? Who trumps, the individual or the community? This is a question that UUs really need to reflect on, the tensions of those two aspects of our principles. Similarly, in this idea of coming together, it's the question of who do we want to include in this coming together? Are we willing to be uncomfortable? In this time of chaos and transformation, there are new voices crying out, new voices that have a lot to offer us here, people that are different from us in many ways. Are we open to be changed by these new voices? How do we create and sustain community in this time of transformation? Part of the challenge of welcoming new voices and new ideas and new ways of being is our emphasis on reason. Reason as the primary way of making meaning and finding meaning. What a glorious thing in our past. You don't have to believe, you don't have to take the word of the Bible. You can reason for yourself to find the answers to what's true for you. But reason is not the end all and the be all. And I think our saving message is a heart message. It's not a head message. We don't transform the world by talking to it about things. We transform the world by the experience that they have when they come and spend time with us and feel and be present and engage. This historical focus on reason has resulted in our disengagement from the body, from intuition, from forms of knowing that are not intellectual. The focus on reason shows up in our UU services, in the emphasis on the written word, in the types of religious education we offer. How about a drumming class? This emphasis on reason is a feature of white culture. It shows up in the conflict-averse approach to problem solving and the conflict-averse approach to decision making. We must be reasonable. Don't get worked up about it. So my final point in reflecting on how you use need to rethink who we are has to do with our religion itself. This idea of the liberal religion, progressive, always moving forward. So maybe, have we gone too far? Have we taken it too far? Those of you who were here for my sermon last month know that I asked you at the end to not tell people that you can believe whatever you want as a UU. You cannot believe whatever you want. We have a theological house. You can find your way, you can build your own theology, but you can't believe whatever you want. If we stand for everything, if we're open to everything, what defines us? I remember when I was in seminary, and I was really fascinated by the late 19th century era when UUs were moving away from Christianity, both the Unitarian and the Universalist branch. And there was a Baptist minister who had converted to Unitarianism, and he said, if the denomination moves away from Christianity, we are setting the stage for our demise. Any business knows an enterprise that attempts to address everything succeeds at nothing. Have we gone too far in our progressive view on religion? I just want to offer a few thoughts on how we might redirect that. And my thoughts are inspired by Susan Fredericks Gray's reading. We must take religion seriously, and we must take our role as religious people seriously. Many of you have come from a religion that was a bad fit for you, but that doesn't mean that you shun all religious ideas. It means that we work together to craft meaning. We build our theological house together. I think sometimes our emphasis on what we believe and not believe about God gets in the way. It's not a healthy thing to define yourself by what you don't believe. When people tell me they don't believe in God, I say, tell me about that God you don't believe in. I'm not trying to convert people to anything. I'm trying to ask the questions about what gives them greater meaning. What does interdependence truly mean? I think we have to be less afraid of some critical theological concepts. One is the idea of suffering and salvation. We don't talk about suffering enough. We don't name suffering enough. The world is suffering. Many of us are suffering. We need to understand what grounds us and sustains us during those times and how we can live in this world where suffering is present in our newspapers and on our media and in our lives. We have to recognize that sin and redemption are worthy concepts for us to consider. We can't create beloved community if we don't have a theology that recognizes that we hurt each other, that we do bad things. How can we come back together after our failures if we don't have a shared concept of redemption or what it means to come back into community? Finally, I think we need a more honest theology about evil. We can embrace our first principle of worth and dignity for every person, and at the same time, acknowledge the human capacity for evil that is very present in our world. Okay, I'm done. Whew, that's my list. Coming back to our house metaphor, I would say this about the state of our theological house. It's got a good, solid foundation, but it needs some updating. And we should consider whether we want to use some new construction materials in that update rather than just building with more of the same. And that is our task. Those of us here today, those of us Unitarian Universalist here today. When new people join the church, I tell them that they've now shifted from being guest to host, that instead of being served food from the kitchen, they are now in the kitchen cooking the food that will be served to all. And I would say the same to you about theology, you who have been UUs for a while and have a grounding in who we are, those of you who have benefited from the saving message of Unitarian Universalists. We are all in this theological reconstruction together. We all have a stake in creating the future of Unitarian Universalism. This is what we do as religious liberals. We evolve our theology in response to changes in the world and changes in humans. We were born at the time of the great revolution that created our country, and we've shifted at great moments in history throughout time, shifted our theology to be relevant and present for the needs of the time. And so now here in the 21st century, we face another time of turmoil and transformation. And it's our time now. It's our time now. Our time to embrace change and be active participants in transformation. So, what will be required of us? Patience, humility, respect for ourselves, respect for others, respect for ideas that don't make sense to us. Curiosity, self-restraint, tolerance, love, risk-taking, willingness to be uncomfortable, because learning and growing requires discomfort. Transformation requires letting go. Oh, and we need gratitude. Perhaps we need gratitude most of all. The mission of this church is to come together and deepen our lives to be a force for healing in the world. And I've said this before, and I will say it again, that the "we come together" part is the most important part of our mission statement. This evolving and living into our theology is a journey, a process, not an outcome. And as I make my way in this chaotic world of ours, I find myself truly sustained by the idea that we are all in this together. All of us here in this room, all of us who need our saving message out in the world. Grounded and encouraged by the powerful UU message of what it is and what it can be, I see great possibilities for the future. It is time now. It is time now for us to thrive. So may it be.